Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to The Tattered Cover. We're very pleased to welcome author Melanie Crowder tonight. Melanie joins us tonight to discuss and sign her brand new book, Audacity. Please join me in welcoming Melanie Crowder.
Thank you. My cheeks are already sore from smiling so much. You are good people. Thank you to the Tattered Cover for hosting this event. We're really lucky to have an independent bookstore like this in our community that's so good to readers and local authors. And thank you. Yeah. So we writers work in isolation. We close ourselves in our little offices and we work month after month after month. And when we finally do get to share our work with people, it's a really big deal. And I'm really grateful that you're all here to celebrate with me. Writing Audacity was a real departure for me. If you would have asked me a few years ago, are you interested in writing historical fiction? I would have said no. That way too much work involved in all that research. If you would have said, are you interested in writing a novel in verse? I would have said, no, that is way too much work. So I guess the moral of the story is never say never, right? If you've never read a verse novel, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I hope that you enjoy this first experience with them. Instead of sentences and chapters, a series of free verse poems tell the story. So it looks like a thick book, but there's not actually that much writing on each page. So despite all that work, Audacity was a joy to write, and it's honestly a story that I'm very honored to tell. So I'd like to tell you a bit about the book, and as I do, I'm going to read a few poems, and I'm also going to read a bit from the back matter, which is a historical note and an interview that I conducted with some members of Clara's family who are still with us. So, without further ado, I need to introduce you all to Clara Lemlich. This is her. She is a real person drawn from the history books and the inspiration for this story. Clara was born in the late 1800s in a small town, what they called a shtetl, in the Russian Empire. She was raised in an Orthodox Jewish family. Her mother bore six children and ran a small grocery store to support the family. Her father was a religious scholar. To give you an idea of what Clara's life was like in the shtetl, I'm going to read you a poem. This one's called Clouds. Over the gray... that's not what I was going to read. Whoa. Sorry. Words. This one's called Words. Mama says, sweep the floor, Clara, like a good girl. But a packed dirt floor is impossible to clean. Scratch, scratch, like a chicken picking grain from grit. I chase the dirt outside where a thick-boned horse pulls a rattling cart down the wide road, his tail switching side to side, flicking the flies from his backside as he passes the goose yard, the stonemason's shed, the tailor's shop, where if I can steal an hour, I can earn a kopeck or two sewing buttonholes. In the market where the Russian peasants sell their goods, a kopeck buys me a scrap of paper inscribed with stout Cyrillic script, a verb translated, conjugated. I set aside the broom, run a dusting cloth over the shelves closest to the window. The smell of spring wanders in on a wayward gust of wind. Across the street from Mama's store, the school is full of children, blonde heads bent over lines of prose, primers held open like siddurs, like prayer books. A handful of Russian words float across the street, mingle in the dust my broom throws in the air. I pause, do not even breathe, my whole body straining to catch the sounds. I turn the new words over and over in my head, on my tongue, until they are mine, over and over as I wipe the windows down, restock the shelves, fetch a bucket of coal from the shed. By the time Mama retires to the kitchen to prepare dinner, the school is shuttered and empty. The Russian girls in their pleated brown dresses and stiff little hats have slung their satchels over their shoulders and skipped home. In the handful of minutes before Mama calls for me, I duck behind the house, follow the paths the red deer stamped into the ground, into the woods. I walk slowly, clouds pinking as the light sinks through the trees. Every few steps I stoop to pick up a feather, a coarse-veined leaf, a small burnished stone. Thrushes till, trill, and tattle from the brush. Today, I have words of my own to trade for their song. Life in the shtetl was restricted by laws imposed by the Russian Empire, and this changed over time as prejudice and hostilities against the Jewish population of Russia shifted. These restrictions included places of residence, travel, occupations, and education, among other things. So from the historical note, since Jewish children were not permitted to attend the local Russian school, and since Clara's deeply religious parents did not condone schooling for girls, Clara's education was an act of disobedience. She taught herself to read and write both Yiddish and Russian, earning money for her informal lessons by teaching songs, sewing buttonholes, and writing letters for her neighbors. In protest of the long-standing anti-Semitism in the region, Clara's father forbade any form of the Russian language in their home, going so far as to throw her books in the fire when she disobeyed. But education was Clara's greatest desire, and this hunger for knowledge frequently placed her at odds with her family. So much so that she had to hide the fact that she was educating herself from her family. This next poem is called Lies. In this life, lies take the shape of words printed on ivory paper, stitched into neat bundles wrapped in linen casings. It has taken years of stolen moments, whispered conversations, borrowed books stashed like contraband, years of lies, but I am nearly fluent in Russian. When life offers me something beyond this, I am ready. Everything changed for Clara in April of 1903 with the Kishinev pogrom. If you aren't familiar with that term, a pogrom was systematic violence against the Jewish population in which the state and the church would either encourage or turn a blind eye to the bloodshed. In this case, a violent mob attacked the Jewish community in Kishinev, killing dozens of people, assaulting and maiming hundreds, desecrating religious objects, and destroying thousands of Jewish homes and shops. It's one thing to live in a society that imposes systematic discrimination against your community, and it's another to be confronted with that level of violence. For many Jewish families, the Kishinev pogrom was a tipping point. Hundreds of thousands of Jews immigrated to the United States between the years 1903 and 1905. The Lemlich family was among them. As I was researching the shtetl and the pogroms and beginning to write the story, it was often on my mind how that kind of a beginning to life would affect a person. Violence, restriction, discrimination, because you're a girl, because you're a Jew. In order to write a character, I have to understand the person, which is a difficult thing to do when your character is a historical figure. No amount of research is going to tell me what Clara thought and how she felt in a given moment. All I could do was research and research and research, and then learn to read between the lines of all that I had gathered. So the Lemlich family left everything behind to travel across Europe and over the Atlantic in steerage class. I'll read three poems now from different parts of that journey. The first, when they're just getting on the train to cross the mainland Europe. It's called Mirrored. The train station is full of people like us, carrying their whole lives on their backs like a great army of snails. Looking into their faces is like looking into a mirror. The same deep furrows, shadowed eyes, pinched lips staring back at me. The space above the tracks shimmers with heat. There was no leisure in summer's arrival this year. Its hot breath blows grit on our faces. The air carries a sharp smell, something I cannot place. Mama's eyes are glassy, constantly blinking, as if she spent the whole day looking into the wind. And then finally, they're in England, and their boat comes, December 3rd, 1904. Three stout masts and two funnels thrust up from the deck, skirted by rooms for those who can pay for a glimpse of the sky. We watch as fine ladies follow a trail of porters, carrying trunks to their cabins, our breath forming frosty clouds of impatience in the air. Then the second class boards, all order and dignity without so much as a glance for us who wait on the docks, perched on the bulging sacks that hold everything we own, the drear that never lifts from the air, wetting our hair, seeping through our skin into our bones. When steerage is called, a flurry of movement spins around us. Families call to each other, link arms, the little ones cry, hold tight against the push and pull that could pry them apart as the great horde of people are herded toward the cargo hold. It does not seem like we will all fit into that hole in the ship's deck, but the line keeps moving. The ship swallows us all. There's no adventure in steerage, in the misery that waits for us beneath. I know why I will send myself into that filthy darkness, but I wonder, as I watch the travel-weary faces march past, what private horrors, improbable hopes spur them on. We shuffle forward until Mama and Papa, my brothers and I, step onto the gangplank, over the gray, foaming water, onto the sea-washed decks. The crewmen, cheeks chapped by rough winds, their eyes fixed in a squint, point us down the steep ladder. In the hold below, lit only by greasy portholes, there is nothing to break the press of unwashed bodies, to move the tepid, stale air. I find myself wishing for the fog, longing for the chill. We claim our bunks, metal slabs, too high, too wide, each covered with a burlap mattress, a life preserver for a pillow, and a small pail for eating, not unlike the one Miriam used to scatter the chicken feed. Papa and Mama and little Benjamin take one bunk. Marcus and Nathan settle into another. I sling my sack onto a top bunk, crawl up after it, turn my face to the tarred planks that separate us from the ice-cold water. The mattress crinkles beneath me, filling the air with a pungent, briny scent. What kind of hay smells like the sea? I pick at a loose seam, pull out a strand of the brittle stuffing, seaweed. The heat at the back of my eyes disperses, the ball in my throat dissolves. I pull my book of poems from the bottom of my sack, hide it in the crook between my knees and shoulders, whisper each line in time to the gently rocking boat. And then one more from when they arrive. Land. We're below decks, when shouts and cheers erupt above. We scramble for the stairs like a crowd fleeing a burning building, everyone rushing to the front of the boat for a glimpse of the thin gray line on the horizon. My brothers hoot and dance. Papa prays. Mama's eyes are bright. Her fingers lift to cover trembling lips. As the ship pulls closer to the harbor, the spires of giant buildings thrust into the clouds. Everyone is pointing, gasping, marveling at the wonder of a city built toward the sky. The port teems with traffic, tugboats, ferries, and small fishing craft rock in the waves we send in all directions. The mother of the exiles holds her torch aloft, greeting us in the water. The clouds break apart, and for a moment, pure, clean rays of sunshine reach through the heavens to dance across my cheeks. Here, at last, a welcome, even for us. Thank you. So the Lemlich family arrived in New York City in December of 1904. By the year 1900, the Lower East Side was packed with more than 700 people per acre, and that was the most crowded neighborhood on the planet. Between 1900 and 1924, 1.75 million Jews immigrated to America's shores, the bulk of them from Eastern Europe. With those kinds of numbers, the basics of supply and demand played havoc with the labor market. An abundance of immigrants, desperate for work, very little worker protections, and very little regulation. Again, from the back, the historical note. Within 2 weeks of her arrival in New York City, Clara was at work in a garment shop on the Lower East Side. Sweatshops in the early 1900s were terrible places to work. An employee had no protection from sexual harassment, dangerous working conditions, and mistakes in the pay envelope or with the clock. There was no minimum wage, compensation for overtime, or injury on the job. And a worker could be fired at any time with no notice. Access to drinking water and toilet facilities were monitored and restricted. If a worker chose to join a union in an attempt to right some of these wrongs, more often than not, she was fired, blacklisted, and subsequently unable to find work. So part of my research included a trip to Manhattan to visit the library at NYU that holds artifacts of Clara's. It was amazing. There were letters, old photographs, her union membership card, and some journals in Russian and Yiddish that I couldn't read, unfortunately. I visited the Tenement Museum and toured a restored apartment there, just like the one that she would have lived in. It was really amazing. And I dragged a few of my writing friends on a walking tour of the Lower East Side so I could see the library Clara studied in, the neighborhood where she lived, the stage where she spoke at Cooper Union, and the courthouse where she was jailed. The trip was a thrill, but more importantly, it was essential for me, both in framing Clara's character and in building the world she lived in. So when we think of a garment factory today, we picture a box-like warehouse with big windows, lit exit doors that open outward in case of emergency, indoor sprinklers, fire alarms, that kind of thing. A garment shop in the early 1900s was a different thing altogether. Sometimes a shop was in a person's home with an iron set up by the stove and a few chairs for the workers cutting and sewing. Other shops were in the back room or basement of a storefront. And there were some modern factories that people were clamoring to work at, such as the Triangle Factory, made infamous by the fire that killed 146 workers, nearly half of them teenage Jewish girls. It had large windows and sewing machines to speed production, but they still had locked exit doors, broken fire escapes, and employees were still treated like property. So Clara left one kind of injustice and landed smack in the middle of another. If she would have been able to keep her head down, to keep her mouth shut, she probably would have had a much more comfortable life. But the history of this country might be very different. I'll leave you with a few words from Clara's daughter, Rita, who allowed me to interview her for my research and to print some of her responses in the book. I asked her about what it was like to be the daughter of such a intense, passionate, visionary woman. And this is what she said. She said, "For years, I shunned away from this because she was my mother. She wasn't Clara Lemlich. She was Clara Shavelson. She was my mother. It's only in recent years that I have begun to realize that while I regarded her as my mother, she was looked upon by other people, probably thousands that I never knew, as a symbol of what somebody can accomplish with sufficient determination. She's still my mother. She's an idol. She really is. She should be." Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. And now, if you have any questions, I would love to answer them. Thank you, Claudia. Claudia Mills, everyone. Wonderful author. How did I first stumble upon Clara as a subject for my work? Well, I was in grad school. I was doing my MFA at Vermont College of Fine Arts. And there they try to encourage us to step outside of our comfort zone and to try new things. And so I thought, okay, I will try some nonfiction. This isn't really what I'm interested in, but I will try it. And I thought about the women who I find most inspiring, the suffragists, the people who were working in that really intense time of battling for women's rights. And what I discovered when I was looking at all of these suffragists was this entire other class, not the suffragists who were college educated, but the suffragists who worked 12 hours in a dirty factory and then went to the picket line. And I just, every kind of offering that these kind of activists have is important. And no one contribution is less than another. But the story that called to me was the story of the activist who had no time to be an activist, and she still found a way to do it anyway. And Clara, she just took hold of me. Once I found her, I had to write the story through to the end. Yeah. Any other questions? Jen? Yeah. So the question was, what happened to her at the end of her life? To which I answer, you have to read the book. No, Clara was an activist for her entire life. There's this lovely anecdote for when she was at a nursing home, the Jewish Home for the Aged, I believe, in California. And she encouraged the orderlies and the nurses at her nursing home, she encouraged them to stand up for their rights and to organize and to make their own union. She never stopped fighting. At different times in her life, her goals changed. You know, she began as a labor activist and she worked in the suffrage movement. She worked as a pacifist. She worked as an anti-fascist in the years leading up to World War II. So she was always active. And her work always centered around these same core values, although the ist, the label, shifted from year to year. Yeah. Anything else? Yes, in the back. Yeah, so the question was, when I was doing my research, was I able to find many personal details about her? And if not, what did I do? Is that, yep. So I researched first by looking at the excellent nonfiction texts that already are out there about people like Rose Schneiderman and Clara Lemlich and Pauline Newman, people who were active in the labor movement. And then, because I figured out pretty quickly that this was going to be fiction, I knew that I needed a more intimate perspective of this. And so I went to the National Archive and I went to the Tamamet Library at NYU, like I was talking, and I read letters and I read things in her own handwriting, things that she had said. I was able to, with permission from the family, listen to a recording that one of the grandchildren had done when she was in her older years, asking questions and just listening to the way that she framed her questions, the cadence of her speech, those kinds of things helped me sink into her character. We never know. Any biography that you read where they are assuming the voice of a historical character, we don't know. We're making our best. We've done the hardest work that we can with research, but we're making our best guess at what their thoughts and emotions may have been. Anything else? Yes, Jeannie.
So you did this because you were interested in the character, but now is it sold you on doing historical?
Oh, my gosh. So, Jeannie Mobley, historical fiction author extraordinaire, asks if I'm going to continue writing historical fiction. And I have to say, there's so much, there's such richness there to be mined that I don't want to say that I never will again. But, oh my goodness, it's so much work. It's so much easier just to make up a story. We still do research with just flat-out fiction, even fantasy. We do research, but not to that extent. Oh my goodness, oh my goodness. So probably, and I'll probably be whining about it at the time. Pam, did I see your hand?
Yeah. I was struck when you said that you have to kind of crawl into who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm wondering is, how did you, in your process along the way, get little signals that you were on the right path, that this was the flow, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So the question is, as I was writing the character, how did I sort of get confirmation or affirmation that I was on the right track, that I was being true to who the person was? The answer I would give for that is that there were certain historical markers, things that she did in her life. There are also interviews with her in newspapers of the time that I was able to read. And newspapers at the time weren't necessarily mostly interested in facts, but they still are a guide. They're still a resource that we can use. And different members of Clara's family have given interviews at different times. And different people have recollections of who she was and what she said and how she felt. But you put the composite of those together and you begin to get a picture for the person. It's a very... Clara's descendants are rightfully very protective of her legacy. They're very proud of her. And they are interested in young people being inspired by her. So they're excited for books like this to come out. And at the same time, they also want to make sure that her legacy is being honored in the process. Yes, Jean. The question was, has the family read the manuscript? Yes. And the answer is no, not yet. My author copies just arrived in the mail today, and I'm sending them a copy, each one of them who spoke with me. But they were wildly helpful. So much that I was having trouble with a sticking point in the genealogy, and they would just emailed me this document that had it all mapped out for me, the entire family history. They were very generous. I'm very grateful to them. Yes. Allison.
This is a question
Yes.
Yes.
Why did I write this in verse? Am I a glutton for punishment? Yes. It's really difficult to do this. I admire the people who do this again and again and again and again. It's a very challenging form. You know, Clara was a visionary. She was a very intense individual. She's the kind of person I suspect who... you would have a conversation with her and you would leave the room having promised your time or your money or something. She was intense. And for that kind of personality, prose felt a little flat. And when I started breaking up the lines and playing with the sounds and repetition and the emphasis and the percussive nature of poetry, it just seemed that, like, hand on fist, it just seemed to fit her. Yes. Last one. Yes.
When during the writing process did you settle on this fantastic title?
Well, the question is, when did I settle on this fantastic title? This actually comes from a quote of Clara's. She was very humble person. And in speaking about her activism in later years, she said, "What did I know about trade unionism? Audacity. That's all I had. Audacity." So it came from her. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.